Good evening, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. We are waiting for more chairs, but in order to save time, I thought I would do the introduction now. Then we can all get seated, then we can all enjoy Professor Surgeon's lecture. I'm also told by colleagues in the Maths Institute that if you all promise to come back next week, we can have the big lecture theatre and we'll all fit into it extremely comfortably. But we have some more chairs. While colleagues are setting them out, I will continue to speak. So it's my privilege on behalf of the Slade electors to welcome you all and to introduce this year's Slade lecturer, Professor David McSurgeon. He's Professor of Art and Film History at the University of Leicester and is widely known as an international authority on Italian Renaissance painting. Just how widely known, I think, is gauged by the number of people very gratifyingly in the room. David has already published major monographs with Yale University Press on Correggio in 1998 and Parmigianino in 2008. He also has significant interests in the history of collecting, which have informed his work as an advisor to major auction houses, museums and galleries, including the National Gallery and Tate Britain, as well as private collectors. He's a trustee of Art UK and of Sir John Soane's Museum, and a former trustee of the National Gallery and of Tate. Another of his areas of expertise is bronze sculpture, and it's this which formed the topic of the most recent of the many exhibitions that he has conceived and curated. The Royal Academy 2012 exhibition, co-curated with Cecilia Treves and simply called Bronze, was explicitly international in scope and innovative in its address to a single material across space and time. It drew international acclaim and almost 250,000 visitors. Almost as many people as appear to be in this room tonight. His book of the exhibition was described by the Wall Street Journal as the most beautiful book published anywhere in the world this year. And it went on to win the Association for Cultural Enterprises Award for Best New Publication. David McSurgeon is also widely known as a critic and commentator on art and exhibitions. It's now exactly 20 years since the Italian Renaissance provided the matter of a Slade lecture series. Professor McSurgeon has two major research enterprises underway at present in this area, one being the Italian Renaissance altarpiece between icon and narrative, and the second being From Drawing to Painting in the Italian Renaissance. And it's this second project which we are fortunate enough to have advanced access to in the form of the 8 lectures he will deliver this term. Can I please ask you to note that after next week's lecture, and we better lay in some more drink, there will be a reception just outside this lecture theatre, an opportunity for a glass of wine and general conversation. Finally, I'd like to thank colleagues in the History of Art Department. I'd like to thank our colleagues in the Maths Institute. But in the History of Art Department, I'd particularly like to thank Rachel Leach and Francesca Issert for work on the publicity and technical support of these lectures. And as they used to say in my youth, if you're all sitting comfortably, please welcome David McSurgeon to give the first of this year's Slade Lectures entitled Drawing in Italy Before 1500.
Well, I must begin by thanking Craig and the electors for placing their trust in me. And before launching into my lecture, I just wanted to say one other thing, which is that I suspect there must have been people standing where I'm standing who said something along the lines of, I never dreamt this would happen to me. I had 3 years as an undergraduate in Cambridge. I had 3 years as a junior research fellow at Balliol and 4 years as something called the Slade Fellow at Corpus. And I suspect, especially towards the end of all of that, I dreamt about this possibility quite a lot. So I can't claim never to have dreamt at all. Now I hope. Everyone can draw. Lest we should forget that simple truth, this enchanting portrait by the early 16th century Veronese artist Giovan Francesco Carotto may serve as an amusing reminder. What is more, and in spite of its subject's beaming pride in his creation, it also underlines the fact that some people are better at it than others. For the 7 remaining weeks of this series of lectures, I will be exploring the achievements of what Miss Jean Brodie would have called the crème de la crème of Italian 16th century draftsmen, starting with Michelangelo and ending with Annibale and Agostino Carracci. And in each case, focusing on a single project and endeavouring to reconstruct its evolution and, in particular, the way in which the artists in question used drawings to make their paintings. One of the purposes of this introductory lecture is to explain the reasons why it is virtually impossible to start such a survey any earlier. In a sense, after all, drawing has always existed, and anyone in possession of a stick or even a finger can make a drawing of a kind. I need hardly add that the ephemeral examples I am showing you do not date from before the dawn of time, but are instead respectively by Max Ernst, photographed by Brassai, and by Goya in his portrait of the Duchess of Alba in the Hispanic Society in New York, where the conceit is that he signed in the sand. Intriguingly, the contract of the 31st of January, 1547, for the Friulian artist Pomponio Amalteo signed and dated altarpiece of 1549 in the parish church at San Martino al Tagliamento, and that's what you see on the left, required him to execute the work in conformity with the drawing he had made on the pavement of the church. And now on the right, Felice Gianni followed the account in Pliny the Younger's Natural History in order to reconstruct a different and only marginally more sophisticated imagining of the birth of art. As a rule, and not unreasonably, we associate drawing with paper, and paper only came to be manufactured in Italy in the late 13th century. A mill was established in Fabriano in 1276, and the city in the Marche remains a noted centre of high-quality paper production to this day. On the other hand, the history of drawing, or at the very least the history of line, starts far, far earlier, especially if our understanding of what constitutes a drawing is not restrictively based upon the media employed to make the image, and thus limited above all to productions in ink and chalk. A number of what are usually referred to as cave paintings might just as easily be called cave drawings. This one in the Chauvet cave is dated to around 30,000 to 28,000 BC. And Greek ceramics, such as these examples of black and red figure ware by Exequius on the left and Euphronios on the right, are among the finest linear compositions ever created. Later on in antiquity, the Etruscans decorated both bronze ciste, I'm showing the Ficorini ciste in the Villa Giulia in Rome, and mirrors indeed, with exquisite narrative designs. At the same time, it's important to note that the almost miraculous survival of the Artemidorus papyrus, only fully published as recently as 2006, which was written in the 1st century BC, possibly in Alexandria, proves that the ancients also produced works corresponding to our standard conception of drawings. If one fast forwards the Middle Ages, yet more media come into play. When it comes to enamels, nothing can rival the myriad scenes on Nicholas of Verdun's Klosterneuburg altar of around 1180, in which I cannot resist pointing out, should you go there, are a short train ride from Vienna. Nothing in the technique of verre églomisé can quite compete, but here too the best pieces, such as these examples from the Victoria and Albert Museum and the Metropolitan in New York, are very fine. I've tried to stress the linear force of these inventions, but it would be a mistake to think that the defining feature of Italian Renaissance drawings is the fact that they are monochrome. Until the later part of the 16th century, coloured drawings are rare indeed. However, this example by Bartolomeo Mantegna, which was sold at Christie's, to whom I'm most grateful for these images last summer, is a very finished compositional study for fresco by him, which you see here, of the Martyrdom of St. Blaise in Verona. Conversely, by the last quarter of the 16th century, Federico Barocci, whom I will be discussing in my seventh lecture, routinely made coloured drawings. In any event, it was always, of course, possible to add colour notes to such preliminary sheets, as Daniele da Volterra did in a study in black chalk for his fresco of the Assumption of the Virgin in Santa Trinita dei Monti in Rome, where the colours and initials for standing for the colours are inscribed in pen. An altogether more detailed approach was adopted by Benedetto Cagliari in a double-sided sheet representing the continents of Scipio, where the main study is on the recto and the colour notes are on a tracing of it on the verso, which explains the flipping of the image. One of the most thrilling innovations of the Italian Renaissance was the virtual invention of what might be described as the thinking out loud drawing. By this I mean those sheets where the artist is not only, in Paul Klee's memorable phrase, taking a line for a walk, but also exploring the possibilities of a given subject or motif, often at speed. Over time, this also led to the practice I will be investigating in my subsequent lectures of executing whole sequences of drawings, above all for major projects, and of giving oneself the freedom to change one's mind. Contemporary commentators such as Giorgio Vasari and Giovanni Andrea Giglio were both very aware of the importance of these related developments. In the introductory section of the second 1568 edition of Vasari's Lives, which is not always included in translations, he begins by stating that disegno, which in Italian means both our words drawing and design, is the father of architecture, sculpture and painting. And a few pages later goes on to explain that, and I quote, "We call sketches a first sort of drawing made to find the manner of the poses and the first composition of the work, and they are made in the form of a mark and represent a single draft of the whole. And because they are such swift expressions of the frenzy, furor is his word, of the artist, whether in pen, charcoal or any other medium, created simply in order to try to capture the spirit of his idea, we call them schizzi, sketches." In the same spirit, in his somewhat later treatise on sacred painting of 1624, Federico Borromeo observed that, and I quote again, "Colours are like words. Once the eyes see them, they sink into the mind just as do words heard by the ears. Correspondingly, making an initial sketch of a subject to be painted is like formulating the preliminary thoughts and arguments in a speech." Conversely, in his Dialogue on the Errors and Abuses of Painters of 1564, Giglio stresses the vital importance of artists making their cartoons, the term used for drawings executed on a scale of 1:1 for paintings, which derives from the Italian cartone, simply meaning big piece of paper. Their cartoon sketches or models should be made well in advance in order to have time to review them 100 times, not as their father, but as their judge, before going on to add to them, subtract from them, emend and correct them. I could show you any number of examples of these practices from the 16th century, by which time it was fully established, but it seems to make sense to choose two groups of related sheets that are not only masterpieces by artists who will reappear in later weeks, but also respectively represent the two main purposes of such thinking out loud, namely thinking about content, what my too kind introducer Craig Clunas has called writing the idea, and thinking about form. Before going any further, however, I must, of course, add that many such drawings combine both these strands. To begin with content, the first two sheets I'm showing you were both by Raphael and the first ideas for an altarpiece. One is an appropriately local drawing in the Ashmolean, while the other is in the Louvre. They represent two variations on the theme of the lamentation over the dead Christ, and their common source is a signed and dated altarpiece of 1495 by Raphael's master Perugino. Raphael's conception, which must date from a little over a decade later, is far from being a mere clone of Perugino's, but the similarities between them are very considerable and might even have been legally imposed upon him by his patrons, not least since such modo et forma, manner and form, clauses are a common feature of contracts for works of art in this period. Be that as it may, Raphael elected to rethink the subject dynamically. One result is a drawing in the British Museum on the left, where the dead Christ is shown lifted up and about to be transported to the tomb, which was further refined in a squared sheet in the Uffizi. Even this, however, was not his last word in terms of the details, since the final altarpiece of the entombment of 1507, which you see, turns the figure of Mary Magdalene out of pure profile, removes her female companion, and rejuvenates the now beardless porter at Christ's feet. A double-sided sheet in the Metropolitan, dating from the 1530s, is a good example of an artist, in this case Parmigianino, exploring different formal approaches without modifying the iconography of his conception. On one side of the sheet are no fewer than 9 studies of Moses about to smash the tablets of the law, matched on the other side by 9 Eves in the main reaching up for the apple of the temptation. None of them quite identical to the final solutions in the frescoes they prepare in the church of Santa Maria della Steccata in Parma. On occasion, artists followed the same general procedure, but concentrated on details. In connection with his work on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo produced numerous studies of arms and hands. Some are virtual variations on the same theme, but could end up in different compositions. Thus, the arms in the black chalk sheet on the left are for 2 of the sons in the drunkenness of Noah, whereas on the right I'm showing a near twin in red chalk, which is for God creating Adam. Elsewhere, as for instance in another somewhat later drawing, Michelangelo explores various possibilities on a single sheet. They are preparatory studies for grieving Virgin in an altarpiece of the Pietà in Viterbo, which was shown at the National Gallery last year. The fact that the finished work is by Michelangelo's associate, Sebastiano del Piombo, may serve as a useful reminder that the authors of drawings need not be responsible for related paintings. It's no coincidence, incidentally, that the close-ups in this sequence are executed in chalk, whereas pen was generally employed for first ideas and studies of whole compositions. As has been indicated, by the first decades of the 16th century, such practices were fairly standard in most, but not all, parts of Italy. Yet it was not ever thus. The idea of making drawings in order to make paintings had to come into being, and I will be devoting most of the rest of my lecture to outlining its gradual emergence. According to Sir John Pope Hennessy, a former occupant of this chair, in provocatively reductionist vein, the study of old master drawings is a means to an end. Enthralling as the individual sheets may be, their importance resides in what they tell us about the creative procedure of an artist. However, even he admitted they could be enthralling, which is presumably why he collected them. Moreover, for all the fascination of the palimpsest-like manuscript come typescript of The Wasteland, or indeed the most impassioned of Beethoven's autograph scores, they cannot begin to compare with sheets such as these. One of the major problems about trying to understand such creative procedures is that only a lamentably small percentage of Renaissance drawings have survived, and that there were demonstrably once many, many more. To borrow the title of an article I recently published on the subject, what is left is the tip of the iceberg. It is pretty scant consolation that a number of sinopie, underdrawings for frescoes, such as this one dating from the 1420s by Masolino for his martyrdom of St. Catherine and San Clemente in Rome, have been uncovered in recent decades. There also exist some drawings on the reverse of panels, which were never intended to be seen, such as this marginally earlier Madonna and Child by an associate of Spinello Aretino that was at Christie's in London last July. One way to prove how much has gone missing is by looking at the documentary evidence, not least in the form of wills. Two 15th century wills of painters so utterly obscure that no works by them are known to survive were both drawn up in Udine. On the 4th of September 1436, the will of one Marco di Daniele leaves his drawings to his pupil, familiari is the word, Giorgio, and everything else to his wife. Similarly, on the 21st of August 1443, the will of Master Antonio the painter, the son of Master Leonardo the painter, requires that his heirs, namely his wife and two sons, cannot and must neither sell nor distribute either the drawings of his art or anything else relating to that art, but must retain them. It seems important to underline that both artists were active in northern Italy, where it is widely assumed the practice of drawing was altogether less common than in central Italy, especially in the 15th century, and that their wills prove they must have had numbers of drawings and not just a handful. This desire to preserve drawings within the workshop, explicitly as tools of the trade, ultimately led to them being collected. Thus, Marcantonio Michiel's notebooks record no fewer than 11 books of drawings in the possession of Gabriele Vendramin, the owner, among other treasures, of Giorgione's Tempest in 1530. Tellingly, only one, a book of drawings by Jacopo Bellini, now in the British Museum, which is described as the big book of drawings on bombazine, which is a kind of fabric, paper in lead point, still exists. All the others have perished. Self-evidently, the habit of keeping drawings together, especially in books, resulted in survivals being a matter of all or nothing, with nothing, alas, usually triumphing. Artists also learnt both from original drawings by their fellow artists and from copies after paintings in other cities, drawn copies. Thus, a beautiful early Leonardo drawing of a lady with a unicorn, this one near me, here in the Ashmolean, which evolved from a more summary study in the British Museum, inspired at least two later 16th century works, in spite of the fact that it was executed almost before Leonardo had achieved a signature style. The earlier of the two is an engraving from the circle of Raphael's associate Marcantonio Raimondi, here reversed for ease of comparison, while the later is a painting by Luca Longhi in the Castel Sant'Angelo in Rome. Only marginally less unexpected is the use of one of Leonardo's studies of horses for his abandoned mural of the Battle of Anghiari, which was borrowed by Bernardino Lanino for his fresco of St. George and the Dragon in Sant'Ambrogio in Milan. In both instances, there are differences between the models and their emulations, which may suggest that there once existed more resolved versions of these inventions by Leonardo. But what is clear is that neither ever became a finished painting. Turning to the request for copy drawings, a now lost letter written to a correspondent in Rome on the 29th of November 1559 by Lelio Orsi, who came from Novellara in northern Italy, asked him to send drawings after Michelangelo's frescoes in the Cappella Paolina in the Vatican. no doubt in connection with his own plans for what appears to have been a projected but never completed altarpiece of the conversion of St. Paul, for which there survive two highly evolved but very different compositional studies, respectively in the Ashmolean here and in the Louvre. In an autobiographical fragment, Raffaello da Montelupo relates that he lost all the drawings he had made of the antiquities of the Eternal City during the sack of Rome in 1527, Cerono Assai, of which there were many. And, as will be discussed next week, Michelangelo made bonfires of hundreds of his drawings. 500 years is a long time for a bit of paper to survive. The other crucial factor before around 1500 is likely to have been a lack of interest on the part of collectors, who in all probability regarded drawings as means to an end and not as works of art. In his Conversations with Picasso of 1964, Brassai quotes Picasso as pronouncing that, "When it comes to drawing, nothing is better than the first sketch." But such an idea would not have occurred to anyone in the Quattrocento. If we go all the way back to the first half of the 14th century, the number of extant drawings is startlingly few. But provided there is a related painting, it does sometimes seem possible to establish whether they are preliminary studies or subsequent derivations. In the case of a drawing in the Uffizi of the Visitation, the links with the fresco in the lower church at Assisi from the school of Giotto are plain enough, and the differences between them are so minimal that it seems reasonable to suppose that the drawing derives from the fresco. Conversely, when a drawing of the Presentation of the Virgin is compared with the celebrated fresco of the same subject in the Baroncelli Chapel in Santa Croce in Florence by Taddeo Gaddi, it's apparent that, for all the general similarities, there are significant changes of mind. Here, too, it is impossible to speak of absolute proof concerning which came first, but the changes strike me as subtle improvements of just the kind an artist of Taddeo's stature might have made. In both cases, the degree of finish of the sheets means that they have, on occasion, been presumed to be what are known as contract drawings. The fact that such drawings existed is well attested, for the simple reason that they are not infrequently referred to in legal contracts. But the number of unimpeachable survivors is tragically small, and they almost all date from well after 1500. One example, which was published in 1908, was in the Archivio di Stato in Parma, and was exhibited in 1935, but is now lost. If anybody knows where it is, see me afterwards. Nevertheless, a faithful copy of it was made in 1803 by somebody called Domenico Muzzi, and that's the sort of bottom center one. It relates to frescoes by Girolamo Mazzola Bedoli for the vault of the choir of the city's cathedral, and is highly finished, but even so, not absolutely followed on the vault, in spite of the fact that the contract of the 5th of April 1538 requires that, and I quote, "within the compartments of triangular form, this painter has to do everything contained in the drawing given by him and included herein." In the event, the notion of including trumpet-playing angels must have evolved later on. Sorry. And the existing drawings for them must have been executed after, and seemingly in defiance of the contract. Intriguingly, the copy is accompanied by two additional pages with unexpectedly free sketches for the vault and the apse. You see them on the left, which it is tempting to imagine the artist scribbling down during the course of a meeting with his patrons. There's nothing especially surprising about these changes, since it seems obvious that only the most stubborn of patrons would have refused to countenance what the artist regarded as improvement. Another incontrovertible contract drawing from towards the end of the century reveals similar divergences from the end product. And in this instance, the possibility of such changes of mind is built into the contract. The drawing in question, which is by Francesco Vanni, is connected with his altarpiece of St. Ansanus baptizing the people of Siena for Siena Cathedral, now in the Church of Santa Maria Assunta there. The drawing has an autographed declaration written by Vanni and countersigned by a cathedral official on its verso that refers to the contract for the altarpiece, which was drawn up on the 15th of June 1593, and Vanni is required to execute the altarpiece, and I quote, in which is to be painted in the lower half the story of when St. Ansanus baptized Siena, and in the upper half the Virgin recommending the city to God her Son, in accordance with the drawing by his hand, which he has left in the cathedral works, which drawing he may improve or expand upon in accordance with the good rules of his art. Here again, the differences are so numerous, I do not have time to chronicle them, but one of the omissions from the painting is of particular interest. In the drawing, the kneeling boy in the left foreground represents a hitherto unrecognized quotation from an engraving by Agostino Carracci after Orazio Sammachini's altarpiece of the Presentation in the Temple in the Basilica of San Giacomo Maggiore in Bologna. But the boy was subsequently dropped. Vanni's altarpiece was one of a pair with a nativity by Alessandro Casolani, who was given a similarly free hand to adapt the now lost drawing he had provided. The phrase in the contract is that it should be in conformity with the sketch he has brought to his most excellent reverence, which may be made better but not worse. I should hope so. A very different contract drawing by Luca Cambiaso, now in Berlin, which you see on the right, is an altogether more schematic effort, which includes the design for the altarpiece's frame and a scratchy inscription penned by the artist. It reads, "This is the sketch which I, Luca Cambiaso, have made for you, Mr. Antonio Rosso, and I promise to make the altarpiece in conformity with it. I, Luca Cambiaso." Set against the drawing by Vanni, it serves to underline the range of possible approaches that might be adopted and demonstrates once and for all that not all contract drawings were highly finished. Drawings must also, on occasion, have served the purpose of demonstrating the artistic competence of the painter in question, as well as the suitability of their invention. Few patrons, however, can have been as exacting as the authorities at San Michele Volterra. On the 19th of May 1442, the Sienese painter Priamo della Quercia was commissioned to paint the high altarpiece of their church, but, and I quote, "and because in Volterra nothing is known except by repute of his mastery, the said master Priamo is content, before starting to paint the said panel, to make and paint on a panel one or more figures at the instance of those who require it, or indeed for himself, to give visible proof of his mastery." Moreover, a document of the 5th of September 1510 reveals Perugino, who was one of the most celebrated painters in all Italy by that date, having to go through an arbitration process over his Nativity of the Virgin altarpiece for San Francesco in Siena, which, alas, was lost in a fire in 1655, so I can't show it to you. In the event, four of his fellow artists found for him against his patrons, but only having, and I quote, "seen the contract for the painting and the time frame given in it, having seen the cartoon and the cartoncino," the little cartoon, that is, "and the finished painting." A further insight into the commissioning process is afforded by a document of the 2nd of February 1603, Sienese style, in which two members of the confraternity of San Gottardo, together with the Camerlingo, the steward, are given authority to be able to make to be made various sorts of drawings and inventions from various painters in order to have made the painting for our chapel. This accords with the reference made to his drawings in the plural in the contract of the 11th of April 1573 for Bernardino Gatti's Assumption of the Virgin altarpiece in Cremona Cathedral. To return at last to the quest for thinking out loud drawings, it has to be admitted the first half of the 15th century is not that much more fertile territory than the 14th. There is a magnificent drawing in the Fitzwilliam in Cambridge connected with Frangelico's deposition at San Marco in Florence, whose status has been much debated. However, and in spite of its closeness to the painting and the touches of red in Christ's halo and the blood issuing from his wounds, I am convinced it was part of the artist's preparatory process as opposed to some species of repeat. On the other hand, it is absolutely plain that Pisanello's chilling drawings of hanged men are first ideas, not afterthoughts. And indeed, one of them, the one on the left, gives every indication of having been studied from a workshop assistant posed in the attitude of one of the unfortunates the artist had previously observed dangling from a gibbet. In this instance, the sole complication is the probability that he drew them almost for the sheer macabre joy of it, and only then inserted them into the background of his fresco of St. George and the Princess in Verona. In any event, the fact that on occasion Pisanello also drew even more spontaneously when preparing pictures is proved by his wonderfully spidery pen study for the eponymous hero of his St. Eustace in the National Gallery. Another blatantly exploratory sequence of studies from the first half of the 15th century is found on Ghiberti's sheet in the Albertina in Vienna for the scene of the flagellation on the earlier of his two baptistry doors in Florence, which was installed in 1424 but had in all likelihood been completed, apart from the amazingly lengthy process of gilding, by 1415. Not only are all five studies of the two flagellants rendered with a quivering exploratory line, but moreover, only the middle figure of the upper register is even close to his counterpart on the actual door. By the second half of the 15th century, this kind of drawing was becoming increasingly common, but it will only be with Leonardo, with whom I will conclude, that it is possible to begin to follow the evolution of a single work across a substantial group of drawings. Nevertheless, in the case of at least one artist of the previous generation, Andrea Mantegna, there are two projects for which there exist multiple studies. To begin with, I'm showing two sheets seemingly intended to prepare a composition which either never led to a painting or were first ideas for one that has not survived. It involved a row of saints possibly intended to flank or surround a virgin and child. Turning to the second project, it's now generally agreed that two double-sided drawings with studies of the entombment of Christ are both by Mantegna and are preparations for his engraving of the entombment with two birds. The entombment with four birds. Between them, they include three studies of the dead Christ and one for the entire group around the tomb. To them may now be added another double-sided drawing, which was sold at auction in Prato in November 2013. It adds another three studies of remarkable intensity, but one of the most striking aspects of the whole series is that the attitudes of only one or two of the figures in them, even allowing for changes of identity and gender, truly foreshadow their equivalents in the print. Another North Italian artist active in the second half of the 15th century, by whom a number of drawings are known, is Vittore Carpaccio. They range from freely handled compositional studies, such as this one for a painting in Avignon, to highly finished studies of individual figures and close-ups of their heads, including those on a double-sided sheet in the Ashmolean for his altarpiece of the apotheosis of St. Ursula. As the 15th century drew to a close, Andrea del Verrocchio, Domenico Ghirlandaio and Luca Signorelli, the artists who were to inspire Leonardo and Michelangelo, the titans of the next generation, were paving the way for their innovations in drawing. In the case of Verrocchio, the two most important aspects of his practice as a draftsman for the teenage Leonardo were his flowingly exploratory pen studies, notably of Putti. I'm showing you one side of a double-sided sheet in the Louvre here on the left, and his spectacularly refined head studies in black chalk, of which this example at Christchurch here in Oxford is surely the most irresistible. Just how close the young Leonardo was to Verrocchio is underlined by another drawing of a female head, this time in metal point heightened with white on rose prepared paper, which has been given to both of them. Personally, I cannot see Leonardo's genius in it, but it is inconceivable that it was not the point de départ for the head of the protagonist in Leonardo's early Madonna in Munich. Domenico Ghirlandaio was a prolific draftsman for the period and left an unusually large number of compositional studies. Some of these, such as this one for his Birth of the Virgin in Santa Maria Novella, are entrancingly schematic, while others, such as a sheet for the naming of the Baptist in the same fresco cycle, are altogether more resolved. At the same time, Ghirlandaio also produced a number of wiry cross-hatched pen drawings for individual figures, such as this servant girl pouring water, likewise for the Birth of the Virgin, not to mention exquisitely finished head studies, variously in metal point, heightened with white on coloured paper and in black chalk, for attendant figures in the same fresco. If Ghirlandaio taught Michelangelo, among so many other things, how to plan compositions and wield a pen, then Signorelli was his great precursor in the study of muscular male anatomy and a master in the use of chalk, still something of a novelty around 1500. He also evidently represented a model in the infinite capacity for taking pains stakes. In spite of the fact that he ultimately slightly changed his mind in the fresco it must be associated with, this black chalk drawing is clearly a study for one of Christ's tormentors in his flagellation at Morra. Yet, when he executed a smaller scale version of the same subject on panel, he evidently restudied the figure of Christ, reversing his prose in another black chalk drawing, which you see, and which, like the second painting, like this painting, is lit from the right. Most European art is lit from the left. Leonardo is the first artist from whose hand a genuine sequence of extant drawings for a particular painting, the Benoit Madonna in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, which must date from the late 1470s, has survived. Although, bizarrely, the fact that they all belong together has not really been acknowledged. They are very much first ideas and are, without exception, executed either in pen and ink or pen and wash. Some of them, a double-sided sheet in the British Museum and the recto of the lady with the unicorn study I showed earlier, as well as a page in the Musée Bonnat at Bayonne, comprise multiple studies of the Christ child playing with a cat, on occasion in the company of his mother, and their quicksilver touch suggests they were sketched after careful observation from the life. Anyone who has seen a child unwittingly tormenting a cat, above all by not letting it escape their clutches, will instantly recognize the scenario. Although in one vignette on the left-hand side here, the cat does appear to be arching its back in delight as it is stroked. Others, a drawing in a private collection in New York on the left and another in the Uffizi, are single studies of the Virgin and Child. By this point in their evolution, the child is established on his mother's lap. One of her arms, which is bent in at the elbow, holds him tight, and she looks down protectively. In a vibrant double-sided study, again in the British Museum, the recto shows the Virgin and Child with the cat in front of an arched window, and the whole composition is almost claustrophobically enclosed within an arch. In the more experimental study, on the reverse, the design is flipped. And in the top left-hand corner of the sheet, Leonardo's drawn an impost block. As will emerge shortly, the impost block is of particular interest in terms of where this is all leading. It has been suggested that the justification for the presence of the cat was a legend that told of a cat giving birth at the same time as the Virgin Mary. Be that as it may, what is clear from X-rays and infrareds, available on the internet but undownloadable, and alas, so you have to go and find them, is that this painting in the Brera in Milan by a pupil or close follower of Leonardo, which is directly inspired by the drawing in the New York Private Collection, or some variant of it, this painting initially showed a cat, which was replaced by the more conventional lamb we see today. It may be that in the end, the idea of including the cat was too quirky, even for Leonardo. Although, later on in the 16th century, both Giulio Romano on the left and Baroccio on the right included cats in Madonna pictures without getting into trouble. In any event, there follows a single sheet in which he explores the notion of showing the child stretching out his right hand in the direction of a windmill toy on another drawing in the British Museum before trying out a solution in which the Virgin appears to be popping food into her son's mouth in the form of a pair of studies on its reverse. The more finished of which again repeats the arched framing and represents the Virgin holding a flower or flowers in her left hand. He then refines the pose of both figures in a sheet in the Louvre, in which the child is represented in profile and is feeding his mother fruit from the shallow bowl she is holding in her right hand. These last three drawings are universally acknowledged to be studies for the Benoit Madonna, which is obviously the one you're seeing, but it is weirdly proposed that the other sheets are preparatory studies of exactly the same date for a now lost or conceivably never completed Madonna of the Cat. This really is one of those cases when Occam's razor comes into its own. Looking at the double-sided British Museum sheet next to the Benoit Madonna, the attitude of the Virgin, the arched format, the round-topped window with impost and all, it seems blindingly obvious that the one led directly to the other. What makes these drawings so thrilling is that they give us a miraculous and time-defying sense that we are looking over Leonardo's shoulder. The other overwhelming feeling one has is that for Leonardo, making them was the absolute opposite of the slavery of a 9-to-5 job. It is no coincidence that both the rise in the status of artists and the practice of the collecting of drawings should have come to pass in this period. The act of drawing was part of a complex development that would gradually lead to an acceptance on both sides of the divide that artists, not patrons, might at least sometimes know best. The extent to which artists thought about subject matter as well as form will be a major theme of these lectures, and there is fascinating evidence in support of such an approach from contemporary sources. In his biography of Giovanni Antonio Sogliani, Vasari relates how the artist wanted to paint a fresco of the feeding of the 5,000 for the Dominican friars at San Marco in Florence, and had already made a drawing of that subject when he was instead forced to execute a representation of the Panis Angelicus, which he did, and I quote, most cleanly and with diligence. And this is a drawing of that subject by Sogliani above and the Panis Angelicus down below. The finished work, which is dated 1536, survives, so we may judge how well he coped. But Vasari adds a crucial comment, and I quote, But it would have been a much greater success for Sogliani if he had executed his own design, because painters do better by expressing their own conceptions than those of others. Towards the end of the 15th century, the almost dementedly quirky, but to me irresistible Umbrian artist Niccolò da Foligno, known as L'Alunno, boldly stated his claim to be taken seriously in an extraordinary and, as far as I can see, almost totally ignored inscription in elegiac couplets on a predella dated 1492, whose translation I owe to my dear friend Professor Stephen Harrison of this parish, so to speak, from Corpus. The predella in question is now in the Louvre, while the main part of the Nativity Polyptych, to which it originally belonged, up above, remains in the Church of San Niccolò at Foligno, for which it was made. And this is the bit with the inscription. The inscription translates as follows. To the reader, the late Brisida, a pious lady, has left in her will that this noble work should be painted. O gift too pleasing to God! If you seek the name of its artist, it is Niccolò Alunno, the fine crown of his native city of Foligno. 8 years had vanished from 1,005 times 100 when the last touch was given to it. But who, O reader, deserved more in your judgment, I ask, when Brisida gave the reason, he the hand? Thank you very much.